Okay, these are not new. We've just heard these statistics, so I'm not going to even read them, but you know that there's been lots of research done on membership retention, losses, and so on. We know these things, we've just heard them recently, but one of the things we have had little or no research on, or even discussion of, is the role of culture in nurture, retention, and reclamation. And yet culture powerfully influences the identity of people, powerfully influences the accepted norms in the church. It is a major factor in how we relate to what the church does and how we join groups and how we don't join groups and many, many other factors that have to do with how we can best disciple people. And so we think that culture needs to be one of those issues that we begin to think more seriously about when it comes to our in many things that we do in the church, and probably especially in how we disciple, nurture, and retain people. So I want to start off by telling you a story that was recently told me by a church pastor. One morning, his two teenage daughters said to him, as they were getting ready to go to church, "We don't want to go to Sabbath school today. We don't want to go to Sabbath school." Now, he was very surprised because these girls had always enjoyed going to Sabbath school and church. They participated in everything, and he was very much surprised. And so he said to them, "Well, why don't you want to go?" And they told him that the previous Sabbath, their Sabbath school teacher, who had just arrived from a very different culture than theirs, said to them, "Today we're going to talk about this particular text." So the girls pulled their iPhones out of their pockets to look up the Bible text, and the teacher began scolding them in front of all their friends. "Don't use those iPhones in church. Put them away. What do you mean? You should bring a real Bible to church. How can you look at your iPhone in church?" And now the girls are saying it's interfering with their nurture, right? They don't want to go to Sabbath school. And if it's left unaddressed, this could actually interfere with their retention eventually. So how do we address these issues? We think we have to address these issues by taking seriously cultural differences. And we don't have time to talk about very many in 20 minutes. I guess, we've been asked, how can we do a 3-week Mission Institute in 20 minutes? Well, we're not going to even try to do that. We're going to just talk about three different cultural values. The first one is individualism, an individualist orientation versus a collectivist oriented cultures. Now, okay. Obviously, every culture has parts of all of these within them. And no culture is totally on one extreme or totally on the other. They're somewhere in a continuum between these differences. Now, the two girls that didn't want to go to Sabbath school, we'll call them Mary and Martha, were from individualist cultures. And in an individualist culture, it's just unacceptable for people who are not your parents to scold you, publicly especially. Because the nuclear family is considered the people who have the right to discipline children. That's very different in collectivist cultures. In collectivist cultures, the whole village raised a child, right? And in fact, it might be said, Oscar, that if the teacher were to come to the parents and say, "Your daughters are doing this, I don't want in my Sabbath school," the parents would say, "Well, why don't you tell them?" But in an individualist culture, that would be the way to do it, is to go to the parents and say, "Can you change what the children are doing?" Because child-rearing practices are very different between these different cultures. Now, in an individualist culture, identities are achieved and chosen. The groups you want to be a part of are those you choose to be a part of. Your status is that which you have earned. This is not because you've been placed there necessarily, but because you have worked to get there or you have chosen to be a part of it. And you choose to be part of a group because their goals and purposes match yours, because you can contribute to the group, because you continue to feel like you're a valued member. You don't just aren't just placed in a group and expected to stay in it. Religious identity, as a result, can become a primary identity. you can choose that as your first identity because your choices, because you have choice about your identity. Very different from a collectivist culture, which Oscar will talk about just now. So your religious identity can become a primary identity, but you can also choose to change that identity. You can choose to leave that group because the individual's goals and aspirations and choices are theirs to decide. Now that really changes how people relate to the church. That changes how they want to interact with the church. There's both positives and negatives to that. One of the examples would be of small groups. Small groups are talked about a lot in our discipleship process. In my home church, we have lots of small groups, but they're always set for a limited period of time. Because in an individualist culture, you're not going to join a group for life. You're just going to join a group for the next 12 weeks to study this part of the Bible or to do this particular activity. There's always a time frame put around it because you want to choose something different afterwards, maybe. And you will only commit to a group for a limited period of time. That is maybe okay in many instances, but it's really difficult for nurture and discipleship. Because until we're willing to commit to a group and stay in it long enough to be really honest and open and authentic, we have a hard time really allowing the Spirit to change us through our group interactions. And yes, I mean, I could probably ask any of you who are from individualist cultures, do you have that kind of small group in your life? And probably most of us would have to say no, because we don't want to join for that kind of commitment. Make that kind of commitment. We have our individual choices. Collectivist cultures, though, have different positives and negatives in them.
As Professor Mbiti says, I am because we are. That's the collectivist culture. In individualist culture, it's the other way around. We are because I am. And that makes a lot all of difference in terms of a church is formed and the way that communities are formed. In collectivist cultures, the individual status and identity are defined by the group. Thus, joining a religion is joining a collective. So religious identity is often as a result of and secondary to a primary group identity, making it difficult to leave the group. Now, group activities that reinforce collective thinking and action are more important than personal contributions to the group's functioning. However, if one does not fit in the group well, whether financially, educationally, socially, ethnically, or wherever, then there is little motivation to stay. So that in a collectivist society, when new members come to church, they need a community to belong to. But if they come and there is no community for them that they can identify with and belong, then they are likely to leave. But in individualist society, people can come, sit, worship, and whatever, and then they go. Their focus is on the worship, on the church. But in collectivist, people want to come and belong to a group.
So Oscar, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that would make a person feel like they don't belong in the group? Like wrong ethnicity, maybe?
The people can come and they want to sit around the ethnicity. They want to speak the same language.
Okay.
Language.
How about clothes?
Even clothes. There are people who feel they don't fit in because, I don't have a good Sabbath suit to go to church like everyone I have seen, because people are always looking around and to see whether they fit in the way that everybody looks.
So to be Thai is to be Buddhist. To be an Adventist in Kenya is to be what people groups?
Yeah, whatever people groups that are there. I mean, if they came and their people group are not...
Okay,
you know,
not present in the church.
Not present. and a group is not deliberately created for them to feel their belonging.
Mm-hmm.
They could feel out and people drift and they are talking in their vernacular, in their languages, and maybe they just feel awkward. They don't feel part of the group and they could easily drop out. And when you look at the growth patterns in, like, for example, Kenya, which is has a significant number of Adventist presence, I mean, the growth is only in particular, actually mainly among two people groups, mainly, out of 42 people groups. Well, because that is how individualist cultures, people go where they are on. So when the missionaries went and they established among people, the first two, the first missionaries that went there, they established the church among two people groups. That is how the church continues to grow even until today. Because of this factor of collectivists, the nature of collectivists.
So other people groups find it difficult to join.
Even they say, no, those... my friend Tom O'Galley is laughing. They say, oh, that is that church belongs to those people. That's not us. It's part of those people's ethnic identities, their culture, but that's not our culture.
So the ethnic identity comes first and the religious identity comes second.
Yeah. Our culture is not to belong to them because that church, the Adventist church, that is their culture. The Anglican church is a culture of another a people group. The Methodist church, the same.
Yeah.
The Presbyterian church, the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that makes a big difference in the way one reaches out and one's
So then when we're talking of nurture and retention, these are the barriers, these are the things then in collectivist cultures we have to think through. How to go across these barriers and how to create communities or space, I'm talking space, to create space within our larger spaces where others who don't speak our language or share our culture then can come, and that way we can create space for them and they can find a place.
So that would make it obvious why there are more multicultural churches in individualist societies than there are in collectivist societies.
Yeah, we can say so.
Yeah. And let's go to the next one here. Change orientation versus tradition-oriented culture. In change-oriented cultures, new is always improved. Always better, right? Whether it really is or not. New is always better. Change is good, even just for change's sake. And change becomes that which attracts people and holds people, especially young people. And we've seen the statistics that the majority of young people that are leaving, the biggest age group that leaves the church are the young adults. So there, and in every culture, whether it's a tradition-oriented culture or a change-oriented culture, young people tend to be more change-oriented than older people. That varies somewhat between cultural groups. So if there isn't change and difference, young people don't find it attractive or welcoming. And we've heard several stories while we've been here of young people who have asked questions like, okay, this is all good knowledge, so what difference does it make? What difference? Is it actually changed your life or not? Is there actually transformation possible? Because change is a very high priority in change-oriented cultures, and especially among young people. So this would be sometimes a generational difference, sometimes it is an ethnic difference, and often a national difference.
This is something that all religions struggle with, tradition versus change. Every religion struggles with this. And both sides, they have good intentions. The intention is, how do we continue to make our religion, our faith, tradition relevant and solid, and so that our truth is guided. This is the whole purpose. So then you have a view that says, okay, for us to do that, let's go back to the old days, how our faith was. If we could only live and behave and do things like the days of Ellen White, oh, this would be great. Or the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, these were glorious days. This is the true faith. We need to go back there. Then you have on the other end, they say, no, for us to preserve our faith and to continue to be a healthy religion, then we need to embrace change. We need to look into the future, the present and the future, and that way then we would be. So both have the same objective, but they are using different approaches. And those, you know, tradition, people are afraid of change, they are suspicious of change. That is why in the story of Martha, called the Martha and Mary, the Sabbath school teacher says, no, don't use the iPhone, the Bible, you bring the real Bible, and the real Bible is that which is in print. Okay, because fearful of maybe, no, the electronic one, that is not a proper Bible. And those who like change, they just love change. They want change for its sake. Change is just good. Now, tradition itself is not necessarily something that is negative or wrong. It is traditionalism that is a problem. Tradition is good.
Okay.
We need tradition. But traditionalism, that of which always wanting to remain in one place and not to change, that is what is a problem. And how does this affect nurture and retention? Mm-hmm. Is that if we are stuck in traditionalism, then we are frozen at a particular point in time and we are not willing to move, or we are afraid of even the present and the future. While God is the one who was and is to come. And so if we are stuck in traditionalism, then we are stuck in the past. But God is also the one who is now and who is to come. And that's where change comes in, because then change allows us to live the present and also to trust in the God who is to come, the future. Cheryl.
Okay. Propositional orientation versus experiential orientation. In cultures that like propositions, and I don't know if you've noticed some of the presentations this weekend, it's very interesting to notice how people approach it. People from propositional oriented cultures, it's all 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, and statements of strategy and that sort of thing, all organized in propositional order. And propositional oriented people tend to be word people. They tend to be people who want to read. So Mary and Martha, when the teacher said, our story is going to be from this particular part of the Bible, they pull their Bible out to read it. That's what we're taught to do. We're word people. We want to see it for ourselves. Quite different from experiential oriented cultures. Experiential oriented cultures that want to experience it and want to hear it. And Oscar will speak more about that. But just a little bit about propositional. This is traditional Adventist training. Okay, one of the first things that Protestantism, for example, did was begin to put the Bible into the local languages and teach literacy. Literacy has been a high value for Adventists, to read the word for ourselves. But there is a difference between being literate and being a propositional culture. There are many literate people who do not learn best by reading. In fact, it is believed that 2/3 of the world are actual oral learners. 2/3. And now, even in our Western world, which has long been a propositional, reading-oriented culture, we have a growing with the generations that are oral and image-based, not word-based. And that really changes the way we reach them. They don't. The words are almost secondary to the image or the sound or the music, for example. It's much more oral, much more like the orality cultures, the experientially oriented cultures. Okay, so what does that mean?
This saying in Kenya, that if you want to hide a secret from a Kenyan, put it in a book. Like it's a joke, but I also saw the statistics the other day that 42% of Americans don't read a book after college. They never read any book after they finish college. And so these estimates suggest that at least 2/3 of the world's population are either pre-illiterate, functionally illiterate, or oral learners. Now, and this is growing. People who we are having people today who can read, but they cannot write. That's another group of people that are coming. But Cheryl just said people that want to experience, people that are visual, more than relying on the print page or the written word. And that will inform the way that we develop our materials. You know, when we are thinking of propositional versus experiential, that will inform the way that we develop even materials for discipleship. Because then these two groups appropriate materials are differently. And let me share this story. A group of evangelists went out, and this happened somewhere in my own country, and they preaching and came to Daniel 7 and explained the timeline and showed these pictures, you know, graphics of the beasts, these images. That was quite something. The next day, early in the morning, somebody visited the evangelist, and they said, "You know what? I've just come to surrender to you to follow the things that you are preaching and teaching. They are really true. Last night I did not sleep. Those beasts of yours attacked me through the whole night. I had nightmares. I need to be saved." Okay? So the way that we present even prophecy, timelines, whatever, is propositional, okay, so that people can process mentally. But other cultures process stuff experientially.
All right.
Through experience.
Okay,
there's many other things that we could talk about, but let's just go to the cut to the chase here. Here's what we would like to recommend. We need to assess the cultural context first. Too often we make a program and then we look at the context we're doing it in. We think about what we're going to say before we think about what they need to hear.
Yeah.
So that's in relationship building, in conflict situations, in program planning. Be culturally self-aware. Each one of us, every disciple maker, needs to be question our stereotypes, suspend judgment, recognize our own ethnocentric attitudes. You know, there in the Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles, there's two doors to get into the museum. One door says prejudiced, and the other one says not prejudiced. The not prejudiced door is locked. Nobody can go in there. You have to walk through the prejudiced door. And we all have to recognize it does not matter what our ethnicity, what our nationality, what our age group, we all are ethnocentric in some ways, and we all need to recognize it. Otherwise, we will impose upon other people in unfortunate ways. And thirdly, commit to receptor-oriented communication. We have to commit to saying, answering the needs people have rather than what we'd like to say to them. We need to ask questions, tell context-specific stories, and read the Bible with the disciples, not for them or at them. We need to read with them, not for them or at them. And you've heard a lot this week about Discovery Bible reading. That is reading with disciples, when we actually help the disciple find the answers in the Bible themselves. And they are always context specific because it comes out of where they are.
Mm.